Welcome to the Science to Business podcast with Nathan Roman and Gary Riccio. I'm Gary.
Hey, Gary. This is Nathan.
So today we're going to finally get a chance to talk a little bit about the sports psychology interests of Nathan and some of the things he's been up to. It's an interesting area where science and business intersect. It's sort of power... it's sort of Moneyball on steroids, you know. So Nathan, tell us a little bit about. Well, maybe let's start. Tell us a little bit about how you got into, you know, how you developed this interest in sports psych.
Yeah, I think my favorite story and how I got into it was my senior year in high school. I had pretty much knew I sealed up getting into UCLA. I knew I was going to get into there. I'd done everything I needed to do, and I was kind of going on senioritis, cruise control mode. And so it was in January, and I was just watching the Australian Open. And this was a long time ago, back in the mid-90s. So I was a big Pete Sampras fan. And I was just watching him and dominate that particular tournament. And he had the sweetest one-handed backhand. Only Federer has something better than his. Best one-handed backhand. And I would just watch him. And at that point, I was just like, I got to have that. So I was just watching, mimicking. I was pretending I was him in my bedroom as I watched him play. And I remember after basketball season ended, I was about a week late into tennis season. And as we were doing drills, we went to the backhand, and my backhand, one-handed backhand, was just smoking. I was hitting line drives, basically down the line, across court. My coach couldn't even return some of them. And I remember after the drills, he was like, how much did you play during the off season? Your backhand's really, really good. And I was really afraid to say I hadn't picked up a racket since the previous season. And before that, I had already intended to go into sports psychology. But that was my own natural, organic feel for imagery on how just imagining social modeling, all that contributed to bettering my game in tennis.
Well, that's a great story, you know. And you hear stories like that from athletes. And you know, you don't know quite what to make of it. You hear it often enough to think that there's got to be something there. So, you know, how does science weigh in on this to tell whether it's, there's actually, you know, real cause effect relationships there?
I mean, there's plenty of research out there, a lot of literature that has shown the effects of, so there's one in particular for free throw shooting. There's four different subjects. One who were basketball players but were told not to practice free throw shooting. Another one was told just to imagine free throw shooting but not do it physically. The third was told to just do it physically, didn't encourage them to do it mentally. And then the fourth group was to do both physical and use imagery in their development. Needless to say, the ones who didn't do anything at all didn't improve, actually regressed. Those who just did imagery had some improvement in their game. Those who just did physical had better improvement than just the imagery, but, you know, saw improvement as well. But the group that did both saw significant improvement over any of the other three by miles. So being able to have research like that to back up things that you've already experienced is great from a practitioner standpoint, which is what I do. Because it gives me a foundation to be able to say, this is why it works. This is how it works. It's not magic. But at the same time, it's great because working with athletes or dancers or musicians or whomever it may be, it is intuitive stuff, but it is nice to have somebody come in and say, with a background, what you think it could work does work, and here's other ways that these skills could transcend and generalize into your other areas of performance.
When would you say... these sorts of effects in sports psychology as a subdiscipline in movement science really kind of turned the corner and became, you know, a lot of people started going into it, a lot of publications started coming out. Do you know from your mentors or from your own independent research, like roughly what year that, you know, what decade or?
I'm glad you asked this question because it brings up kind of where we are here in the States compared to the rest of the world, because I would say one of the biggest things, at least in our field, the biggest times was during the Olympics, particularly in the 60s to the 70s, because Soviet Russia, Eastern Germany, they didn't have the same equipment, the same kind of training resources that we had here in the States. They had some, but it was very, very much third world, not even developing, but third world type facilities. But they did have an understanding and an embracing of the mental aspect. And yes, they had a lot of great athletes, but they really utilized their academies with sports psychology to maximize the potential that they had. And so in that sense, we in the States are actually behind the Russians, the Germans, the Australians, the New Zealanders in many, many ways, because they've already been embracing it for decades, where here in the States, we still have a lot of pushback. It's growing. There's a lot more embracing of it, but still there's people who haven't heard of it, where in other countries it's a necessary form of their training. Otherwise, they just wouldn't go to that academy.
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, I noticed after the breakup of the Soviet Union and we started to get students coming to the University of Illinois where I was teaching, you know, at the time, you know, late 1980s, early 1990s, you know, one of the things I noticed is they were just generally so much more comfortable with crossing the Rubicon from like mind issues to body issues. You know, it's so separate, right. Had been so separate for most of the 20th century in the United States. You know, we just had this kind of strict separation of mind and body. We couldn't talk about them, couldn't think about them in the same way. You know, the disciplines, you know, various subdisciplines of biology and the various subdisciplines of psychology, you know, really didn't talk with one another very much. They're very separated, even within psychology departments. And it was right. Funny, you know, psychology and kinesiology departments, they had this kind of similar structure. They were unusual in the sense that they would have biologists, psychologists, physicists, all within that department, but they were often in completely different, you know, sections of the building. Mm-hmm. And for very practical reasons, but it was sort of very telling, right? Mm-hmm. For very practical reasons, it was typically the case that the sport physiologists in kinesiology and the biopsychologists in psychology would often be behind locked doors in the basement. And, you know, there were sort of good reasons for that, given things they had to kind of be careful of and protect. You know, if they were working with, you know, sensitive substances or animals or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was just, it sort of made this point on a number of levels about the separation between mind and body. And it was just such a pleasant surprise, an injection of a different way of thinking when, you know, a lot of these, you know, and they weren't even kids, because a lot of the students that we would have coming over were, you know, people who were, you know, well into their 30s, you know, and so had been practicing researchers for a while, you know, from behind what had been the Iron Curtain. And it was really, they were a disruptive influence. It was really good, I think. Yeah. And now, I mean, I think we've come a long way in the last 25 years in just the amount, even popular interest in things that cross the mind-body divide. And, you know, things like, you know, even psychosomatic medicine is a very hot topic, you know, right here at Harvard. There are some really interesting things coming out about, you know, positive effects of placebo and the various different kinds of placebo effects there are and how, you know, some of them can actually become part of medical practice. Yeah. So we've just come a long way. And as I say, crossing the Rubicon from mind to body, and you know, it seems that we really are at a place where this can start developing into various kinds of businesses. Now, in our last episode, Nathan, you'll recall, we talked a little bit about Moneyball in the context of
data analytics
and business. Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, it seems to me that now that that's been taken seriously and people are ready to go beyond behavior statistics, that is to say, statistics about, you know, the way athletes behave and perform, you know, we might be ready for businesses to start taking advantage of the way people think about motor learning, the way they learn a skill and the way they perform. So tell us a little bit about the stuff that you're involved in, which really is a business, gets into the business of that.
So, I mean, you're starting to go down that path where I love the culture development as well. I love individuals and I love team aspects. And I'm really fascinated with leaders, coaches, on how they're able to assess talent, maximize the individual talent, but also be able to bring them together, various pieces together, so that the team works well, understanding the different roles, being able to articulate those roles, being able to articulate their own little coaching or leadership philosophy and how that ethos just pervades throughout the team so that people can have something to go to. And as they're going towards whatever goal that they're going towards, they have that structure so that they could be creative, they could be innovative, they could fail, they could, you know, go and get the help that they need. They know how to iterate. That's the stuff that really fascinates me.
So, you know, you hear this, you know, most recently, it wasn't that long ago, we had, you know, the Super Bowl, and you hear a lot about, you know, Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
How, you know, if Bill Belichick's the master tactician, right? You know, the guy who works 23 hours and 45 minutes a day, you know, at his whiteboard or chalkboard, you know, figuring out tactics, and he does it very well. Then, you know, Pete Carroll's success is, you know, at least in the public, right? General public is attributed to, you know, I think the kind of things you're talking about. Is that right from your perspective, as an insider's perspective?
Yeah, for my chagrin, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Pete Carroll because of what he did at SC. But the culture that he's developed, at least, like you said, from the public perspective, that's almost the archetype of what you would want, not only in a team, but in an NFL team where there's a certain culture that you see, like in the Dolphins, and how at the time with the Richie Incognito fiasco and all the bullying, and how you have a certain mentality where there's hazing and bullying and you have to be tough. Pete Carroll, from just what I've seen and read and observed, he has very much an atmosphere of you're here to play this game. Yes, you're tough. Yes, you're the best in the world because nobody else really in the world plays football. So, yeah, obviously you're the best in the world. And this is an environment for you to be who you are. You don't have to be something you're not. And we're going to give you those outlets to be able to do that. If you're the type that's introverted and quiet, we have the resources that you need. You have a sports psychologist, you have yoga and the such. If you're the type that needs to be pumped up and jacked, you have this area. He's been able to facilitate a culture so that people can be who they are, but they come together for the most part and maximize the sum of their parts. And it's really impressive. And I think the more success that he has, the more of a job I get to have out there.
Well, so you've brought up something that's really important, and I would say is not something that's well appreciated among lay people about psychological science. You know, psychological science is different in a lot of ways from other sciences, and I think the most significant way psychological science is different is in having to deal with variability. You know, it's just individual differences are really important, you know, and in most sciences, you're sort of looking at, you know, means, central tendency. I mean, you do in psychology as well, but, you know, especially where science translates into business, you know, being able to deal with individuals as such, you know, human beings are complicated. You know, yeah. There are lots of different ways to get to the same goal.
Right.
So, you know, your profession, right, and you're utilizing sports psychology in business, and as you've talked with me about it, I mean, it seems like it's very much, you know, a one-on-one thing, very much about individuals. And it seems to me that's what you were talking about with Pete Carroll is not just a, you know, sort of developing a climate where psychologically people understand how they fit into the team and have what they need, but that there are different kinds of individuals within that team. So talk to us a little bit about how you address that individual dimension. You can't have a one size fit all solution in your work.
No. And what it comes down to is basically having an understanding of the fundamentals of thinking, critical thought, empathy, some of these in my toolbox. And then when I work with an athlete, it's about getting to know them, doing that assessment. And it's not just like a check the box type assessment, but a true get to know what is it, because some athletes, they may need stress and anxiety help, you know, how to reassess certain situations in games. Other athletes, they just need that little extra imagery boost, how to refine that particular aspect of a game. Some coaches, they need to have a greater development of their empathy, or some coaches need to have a greater understanding of individuals. So, yes, it's very much one-on-one before you can really do the work, because you can't just give them a program and say, here, you can watch these videos and you're going to be fine and dandy. You need the feedback. We have a lot of great resources for that, but unless we have the feedback given to them, it just won't work.
Now you've worked a lot, if not mostly, with young kids, right?
Yeah. Adolescents. Correct.
Okay. So, you know, high school and before high school.
Correct.
So give us some examples of, you know, situations where there were problems that, you know, some kids were having in their sport and how you helped them overcome.
Oh, okay. So this one particular aspect was a burnout. Kid was playing the sport for a very long time and very good at it, but was just burning out. And one of the things I had to recommend to him, I had to ask, you know, what else does he like to do? What else does he, you know, find enjoyment in? And he named off various other sports. And he was junior high-ish. And so it was very much a recommendation of to cut back on that one particular sport and then to try these other sports. Because these other sports afforded him time with his other friends that weren't just playing football. But if he wanted to play soccer or hockey or basketball, whatever it may be. But also, the pitch to the parents was, this also develops him better physically and cognitively for football, because the footwork he learns in soccer is great, or the pattern recognition in basketball is great, as well as being able to interact with his friends, which allowed him to be a little bit more happier with life and avoid burnout. So those are fun, because it's almost like you're giving them... You're helping them get to that place of enlightenment of we don't have to silo it off, which is also kind of what we were talking about earlier in terms of academia and how we've just, you know, siloed off, you know, what goes on in the mind, what goes on in the body. Same thing happens in sport. We think if you just focus, you're going to be the greatest ever. There's a certain point in your athletic career where you do have to do that. But when you're young, that's not the ideal. You really do want that holistic approach, because physically, it's great for your game. But more importantly, that emotional, being able to hang out, being able to do something different, being able to not burn out is really important.
What's fascinating to me, and I imagine to a lot of listeners, something that's even counterintuitive in what you're saying, is that, you know, adolescents can be receptive to this kind of assistance, which sounds deeply self-reflective. And, you know, we often think of, maybe we think back to our own adolescence or struggles we're having with adolescence, you know, at the time, as, you know, people going through a period of their life where they're just, you know, really struggling and changing in lots of different ways and not being especially self-reflective. So, Tell us about that receptivity, or maybe it's difficult.
No, it is difficult for them because a lot of times they don't know how to articulate it. And it really does take the adult to be able to, one, recognize, but then two, ask the questions and lead the adolescent in that.
Are they comfortable with it, though? I mean, in terms of feelings, is it threatening to them?
In my experience, it does depend on who it is. Like for me, myself as a third person outsider, somebody that they trust, very much more apt. The parent, depending on how they've approached their parenting with this child up to that point, that's when it could get kind of iffy. But it is nice to have a third person, whether it be myself, their coach, teammates, whoever, that they can kind of open up to. And it's always nice when the adult, like myself, has some kind of authority where it's to say, you know what, this is fine. You're fine to feel this way. This is actually normal. And this is how I've seen some ways to alleviate this. And a lot of times that's kind of what they want to hear. They want to just hear somebody validate what they were already thinking and feeling, but they feel like they've been told they have to do the certain thing in order to be the best. And so, you know, adolescents, whatever you may think of them, they actually are way more respectful than we give them credit for. And so they listen more, which also leads them down this path of, you know, going through crap that they don't really have to go through.
And so you know of companies or individuals who are actually providing services as a business to, you know, adolescents, or maybe even to coaches of junior high and high school teams or junior teams. Does that seem to be something that's, you know, that's increasing?
It is. You see a lot of individual, like, sports psychologists. I'm very fortunate to be part of a team and an established team, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do it. But there's a lot of individuals that are sports psychologists on their own. A lot of them are clinically trained psychologists as well. And so they're able to help both aspects. And so no matter where you are, this is definitely growing. And there's a lot of clinical psychologists that, after they've been practicing, have fallen into sports psychology. And so you see it growing in that aspect.
So if I was a parent or a coach or a student, right, a young student, and I wanted to find out a little bit more about, you know, people in my area who do this sort of thing, you know, what, I mean, you know, people Google, right? So right. How would I go about getting a little bit better educated on what's out there?
Right. Well,
and how can I avoid the charlatans? Because I'm sure there's some charlatans out there.
Yeah, there are definitely charlatans, and, you know, you definitely want to. I mean, I guess I could put a plug in for my company, Mental Training Inc. We're based in Dallas, but we're all over. I'm here in New England. We have people in California, in Europe, in Australia, all over the place. And you could see by who our past clients and current clients are that we do have credibility.
Now, are there certifications or degrees that people should be looking for? So if they're not looking at your company, they're just, you know, doing a search. How are they going to know who's legit?
Right, right. And so there is certification. So we have an organization, the governing body called the Association for Applied Sports Psychology, and there's a certification through there. And in my company, you're either ASP certified or you're going to be ASP certified, but already certified through our company. And that entails training in terms of best practices to ethical issues to, you know, just like clinical hours, like a clinical psychologist would go through, but hours with athletes, hours with business people going through sessions. And that's what you really would like to look for, some kind of certification for sports psychology. Obviously, if you need something more than sports psychology, which is performance enhancement, such as if you have a eating disorder or if you're struggling with depression, whatever it may be, you definitely want to go to a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist that is certified there. We that are just certified in sports psychology, we are not trained to do that. We don't have the education. And so we usually refer clients where those issues do come up. But for the most part, if you're just looking for a sports psychologist for your team, for your company, for your dance troupe, whatever it may be, certification through ASP or through Mental Training Inc. is sufficient.
Well, and as this interview or conversation would indicate, you know, talk to the person, right? And a great indicator of whether somebody is legit or not is whether they're willing to spontaneously talk about what they don't do or what they shouldn't do, or you know, somebody else they would refer you to for a more comprehensive approach to whatever your issues might be. So, which is just what Nathan did without me asking. So, right. I mean, this has been really interesting, Nathan. I think we should maybe next week, let's talk a little bit more about, you know, a particular attribute of what you do. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the imagery and.
Yeah, and, I love to talk about like stories and other aspects in terms of that really, really show how sports psychology is impacting people.
Yeah, let's do that next week.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about. Here's what I've been wanting to talk about. Let's talk about leadership, like micromanaging versus leaders that know their talent and how to utilize them.
Oh wow, that would be great. And we've both done a lot of work in that area, so that'll be a good conversation. So
I figured you would have some good stories to throw in on that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so wait for our next podcast, and we will continue the conversation. Nathan, as always, it's fun.
Yes, love this conversation.
And, you know, for Nathan Roman, this is Gary Riccio on the Science to Business podcast, and we'll see you next time.